right, go ahead and have a seat. This morning we're hearing, our first case is State v. Scott Forich. It's 1850. Could I have your appearances, please? Good morning. I have the lineup as 25 minutes, 30 minutes, back to 5 minutes, right? And we also have Kingdom Prep Lutheran High School here today from Wauwatosa. It's nice to see all of you. Welcome. It's nice to have you here. Could you go ahead and stand up so we can properly just say hello?
Oh, wow. Good group.
Good group. Perfect. All right. Have a seat. Welcome. If you have time later today, after we're done with oral arguments this morning, Justice Rebecca Bradley would be the one who would be coming to speak to you. She won't talk to you about the cases today, but she can talk to you about court procedure or answer any questions you might have. So I'd ask you to really think of tough ones because she's smart and she likes to be challenged, and that'd be good for her today to have one more thing to look forward to. So welcome. It's nice to see you. With respect to the first case, are you ready to proceed, Mr. Sanders? Before we do, I just want to acknowledge that one of my colleagues is just a fierce competitor, both in and out of court, and part of that competition has caused her to have a little back issue that she's recently tried to take care of, and so she may be standing more than sitting, so just don't even pay attention to that. She's happy to be here in court.
Okay?
All right.
May it please the court. The Court of Appeals said it was following Birchfield and Dalton when it struck down Wisconsin's OWI and enhancement statutes, but neither of those cases even suggested, much less compelled, the result that the court reached. Those cases did not deal with sentence and enhancement at all. The court was wrong to find that, to find these laws unconstitutional, and this court should reverse. I'd like to start with Birchfield. In that case, the Supreme Court dealt with whether implied consent laws that go beyond revocation or refusing a blood test and make it a crime to refuse a blood test under an implied consent law are okay. The court said that they are not. You cannot make it a crime to refuse a blood test under an implied consent law because a law that does that threatens the suspect with an unreasonable search. But the court drew a line and said those are not okay, but a law that gives the suspect a choice of either civil penalties and evidentiary consequences or a blood test are fine. And our law does exactly that. All our law does is say, you have a choice. You can either take the test. If you don't take it, you are going to lose your license, and we can use your refusal against you in court to prove you guilty of a crime. And there are some more things, but those are the two main things which are going to occur. But our law, but in the Supreme Court, they didn't say anything about whether you can use a revocation for refusing a blood test in one case to enhance the sentence if you drive drunk again in another case.
Counsel, would the Court of Appeals, you know, says that, you know, that and they point out Dalton in particular and say we feel bound by that. What is your sort of best argument distinguishing Dalton? You talk about it a bit in your brief. The brief we got from Eau Claire seems to say, you know, we should really construe Dalton narrowly because it might, you know, might take us in a different direction. But what is your best effort to distinguish Dalton and what it says?
That dealt with a That dealt with what a court did at sentencing. I don't think that in that case the search was in any way unconstitutional. What the court dealt with there was a judge who explicitly said, I'm going to give you more time because you refused a blood test. And this court said that, I think, got too close to what the U.S. Supreme Court said you can't do,
right. Because
that kind of made it a crime to refuse. I didn't mean that. It didn't make it a crime to refuse, but it did, according to this court, impose extra time because he said no, and therefore that is a violation of Birchfield.
Sure. So obviously different fact scenario for sure. Mm-hmm. But can you help me draw a legal boundary around that? Obviously different situation. You know, there's some time.
Oh, sure.
What's the legal distinction that you would make? Where's the sort of doctrinal boundary line between the outcome of that case and this one that you would draw, that you would advocate we draw?
Well, I think the way that case can be right and this case is wrong, there are ways, and I think the one which is simplest is that this deals with using a refusal. It deals with using a revocation for refusing in one case to enhance the sentence in another future case. And there's about 140 years of law that says that when that happens, you are not, that the time you get for the new case, because it is enhanced, is not a punishment for what you did, for what you have done in the past, even though that is what enhances the new case.
The 140 years you're talking about are related to criminal convictions, correct?
I couldn't hear what you said.
The 140 years of law you're talking about relate to criminal convictions and the use of a criminal conviction later to enhance a penalty, right?
Not always a criminal conviction. It would also include civil ones, like in Wisconsin, where in state v. in a case that I did not cite in the brief, State v. Novak in 1982. It's 107 with second 3-1 from 1982. The court said it is, of course, okay to use a first offense in Wisconsin, which is not a crime, to make your next one a crime.
Right. So let's separate that out a little bit.
Sure.
I want to go back to something that you said earlier, which is that you said that Dalton imposed extra time because he said no, and he refused, and that is a violation of Birchfield. So please explain to me how in later enhancing a sentence based on saying no, based on refusing, is any different. Aren't you still imposing extra time because the person refused? And that's the only basis, because that is the basis of the revocation.
No, because, again, for 140 years, it's been clear that that isn't how it works when you impose an enhanced sentence. It's clear that 100% of the enhanced sentence is for that case. And I cited about, in the brief, I cited a lot of cases which all say the same thing. I don't know of a single case anywhere that has ever said that that's wrong, except for one case in the U.S. Supreme Court, which has been overruled by Nichols, which I rely on heavily in the brief, and which says that that's how sentence enhancement works. There's that case, and there's this case. As far as I know, those are the only two ever.
All right. So you want to divorce... I mean, the whole basis of Birchfield, as I read it, and as we stated in Dalton, is that you're giving someone a criminal penalty
mm-hmm.
based on the refusal, which violates their Fourth Amendment rights.
Mm.
You can't do that. So you want to somehow divorce that piece from later being able to give a criminal penalty based on something that could violate your
because
Fourth Amendment
right. Because what you do later is not a criminal penalty for the refusal. And that's been the case for 140 years. It just isn't.
Well, I don't know that this case has come up for 140 years, so I don't. You're using law that is based on criminal convictions. We're going back to that again, and I know we're not. I know we're talking past each other, so I.
But well, I guess in a way to just think about how this works. You do A, and then you do B, and B, and you get more time for B because you did A. Any time you get for B is not it's not an additional punishment for A. That's just how the law has always worked. That's how every enhancement statute works. And in this case, I think if you think about what occurred here, when he pled in this case, he said, I have 6 convictions and revocations that count. One of them was his first offense, which is not a crime. 4 were crimes, and 1 was this revocation. If the Court of Appeals is right, and that the fact that he got more time now because he had 6 of them is actually a punishment for those, that would mean that all of the time he got now could be attributed to his first offense, to his second, his third, his fourth, his fifth, and his sixth, and that's wrong. It just doesn't work that way. You have to have all of those, but this isn't more time for any of those. And it can't be, because under our state law, you couldn't impose the 11-year sentence he got in this case for what he did in his first offense, which is not even a crime, or for his revocation, which isn't a crime, or for any of his other crimes, which can't have an 11-year sentence.
Can we talk just a little bit, and I'd like you to think about this too, about remedy. What is the remedy that's being sought here, and why is that an appropriate remedy?
What the Court of Appeals said is that the case would be sent back and they would impose a sentence for a 6th offense rather than a 7th.
But I don't understand why it would just go back for sentencing. Why wouldn't it be a withdrawal of plea and all the charges be reinstituted and you have the right to go to trial or not? Why would it just go back for sentencing? That doesn't make sense to me. That seems to be the wrong remedy if the court buys what the defense is selling today.
I would want to think about that a little bit more. I hadn't really thought about the remedy because I think it's just so plainly wrong that what the court did is just so wrong that I guess I didn't expect the court is going to affirm it. So I didn't really think about the remedy. This isn't a case where, like, one of the three three defendants in Birchfield where his search was an unreasonable search because he was threatened with jail. So there, it wasn't a matter of sentencing. Instead, his plea was withdrawn, and he couldn't have been convicted in that case. And that makes sense. But here, this has nothing to do with the search. This can't in any way, like, it makes no sense that using this to enhance his sentence in 2016 or 17 make his search in 1996 somehow not a reasonable search.
If we agree with the defense that somehow this isn't this number offense, therefore you cannot be sentenced for this number offense, the plea is faulty. And the agreement that the refusal is unreasonable is faulty, the plea should be withdrawn and the case should be tried, and all the counts that were dismissed should be active again, shouldn't they?
I think that's probably true because it was a plea. Had it been, had he gone to...
Wasn't a trial.
Yeah.
It was a plea.
I think that's right.
Specifically agreed that the refusal was unreasonable as a part of the plea.
I believe that's true.
Well, that's what the plea form says. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that makes sense to me because it was a plea.
If we agree with the defense, the remedy isn't sentencing. The remedy is you get to go back and be charged with all these crimes and go forward and go to trial, right?
Sure. Yes.
Mr. Sanders?
Yes.
Can we go back to the questions that Justice Hagedorn was
yes.
And my question is, are you asking us to overrule the very well-written opinion in Dalton, or are you just, what I hear, in response to Justice Hagedorn's question, I heard you distinguish it, but I think he asked you to distinguish it. Is that what you're asking us to do? Because I'm looking at paragraph 63 in Dalton, where this court is quoting Birchfield. I'm just going to read one sentence, and it says, although Birchfield states that, quote, motorists cannot be deemed to have consented to submit to a blood test on pain of committing a criminal offense, I'll wait for you to...
Yes, oh, yes.
I'm just on paragraph 63.
Sure, thank you.
There's only two sentences. Mm-hmm. It also addresses the wider impermissibility of criminal penalties for refusal, not only to criminal charges. So my question for you is, what are you asking us to do with regard to Dalton, number one? And number two, the hiccup for me here is, but for this refusal, Mr. Ferret, or is it Ferret?
I'm not sure.
Ferret. Ferret, thank you. Okay. Mr. Ferret would not have faced the increase in penalty. Now, interesting, if this had been an OWI 8, it wouldn't have mattered, right? But because we're going from a 6 to a 7, it makes a very, very big difference here. So,
okay. Well, on the but-for test, I would ask this court to read a lot of the cases that I cited in the brief that starts back in 1880. It's absolutely clear that it is not a but-for test. It, of course, makes sense that if there weren't a refusal, then this would not be this number of offense. But that doesn't mean that the additional time is for that refusal, because that isn't how any of the sentencing law works. It's not a but-for test. If it were, then that would also mean that but for his first offense, he couldn't have had a seventh. And so all of the time that he got because it's a seventh would go to the first, which can't even have any time because it's not a crime.
But regardless,
it just doesn't work that way.
Regardless of the fact that the first offense is not a crime in the state of Wisconsin, nobody has a constitutional right to drive under the influence of alcohol, right?
Of course.
But of course, people do have a constitutional right to refuse to have a needle stuck in their arm and blood drawn.
If I may, they have a constitutional right to be free from an unreasonable search. So if the search is not reasonable, they of course have a right to refuse. If the search is reasonable, they don't have a right to refuse. In this case, it was a reasonable search. He was told, if you say no, you aren't going to go to jail, but you will have some civil penalties, you are going to lose your license, and we can use it against you in court. He got a choice. He made the choice, which was, I don't want to have my blood drawn. And his blood was not drawn under the implied consent law.
And as a result of exercising his constitutional right to refuse the blood draw, he exposed himself to more than 10 years, which would have been the maximum.
Except he didn't have a constitutional right to refuse the blood draw because he was not threatened with an unreasonable search. He was threatened with a completely reasonable search. And all the Fourth Amendment says is not you have a right not to be searched. It's that you have a right not to be searched unreasonably. You have a right to be free from an unreasonable search. And what the Supreme Court said when they decided Birchfield is that there is a line. If you are threatened with jail, that is an unreasonable search. If you're not, it's not. And our law only threatens civil penalties and evidentiary consequences, and that's okay.
But our law also, the way the statutes are drafted, they really do threaten, although it's a fiction because who has read them, right? Although people are presumed to know the law. But the way the penalty structure works, the threat is there. It's written into law because the refusal is counted.
Except that that's for 140 years, it's been clear that that's not how it works when you enhance the sentence. That isn't a penalty for what you did in the past. It's not a penalty for the first, the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth, or the sixth. It's a penalty for the seventh because it's a seventh. And that's what the what this court said as long ago as 1880, and the U.S. Supreme Court has said repeatedly that it's not a penalty for what you did in the past. And that's the same if it's a three strikes law. What you get for the third strike is not a penalty for the first strike or the second strike. And in Wisconsin, if you think about something like intoxicated use of a vehicle where you cause death, you can get an extra 25 years if it's offense number two, and that can't be attributed to what you did in the first one, because that could have been a first offense, which isn't even a crime. It just isn't a penalty for what you did in the first case. And that's how every sentencing statute works in this state and in the federal sentencing guidelines. That's just how sentencing works. It's not a punishment for the earlier crime. It's a punishment for the new crime.
Sure feels like maybe it might
be. It absolutely does, and I totally understand why it feels like
that.
It's just not right.
Okay.
It's just contrary to 140 years of case law.
I have
and I don't think there's any way around it, and I apologize that I kept talking.
No, you only will have to apologize if you have not to apologize at all. I was going to say teasingly, you only have to apologize if you disagree with me vis-a-vis this next question, okay?
Okay.
Fair enough. Okay. I yield my time. No.
And he doesn't have a standing apology in that regard.
No. Okay, counsel. Justice Garofsky read to you referred to you paragraph 63 of the Dalton opinion. And it reads in part, and parts of your argument seem to address this, but I'm not sure it's consistent with Dalton. Paragraph 63, after skipping the first two sentences, states, although Birchfield states that motorists cannot be deemed to have consented to submit to a blood test on pain of committing criminal offense, it also addresses the wider impermissibility of criminal penalties, so penalties is what I'm referring to, for refusal, not only criminal charges. And, of course, we have an enhanced penalty statute that we're addressing here today. Is that statement correct?
Yes, but that explains why this court reached the result it did in State v. Dalton. It does not explain why the Court of Appeals reached the result it did in this case. Because as this court said in Dalton, when the judge said, I'm going to give you more time for this, he explicitly gave him more time, which this court viewed as a criminal punishment for the refusal. What occurred here is not the same, because when you enhance a sentence, you're not imposing any additional time for what he did in the past. It's only for the current offense. And that's why it's not the same. That's why this court doesn't have to say it was wrong at Dalton. It doesn't have to overrule Dalton. It doesn't have to do anything with Dalton. All it has to say is, as a matter of sentencing law, when there is an enhanced sentence, 100% of that additional time is for the new case. It's not for the old case. It just isn't the same. I get the but-for. It makes an intuitive sense. It's just wrong. Well, it's just not how sentencing law works.
I'm looking at the 1880 case right now.
There's a lot more cases.
Well, and I've read a lot of what you cited, too. And although it is not a punishment for anything but the case that's in front of the court, which is why it's not double jeopardy, do you stand here and argue to us today that you're really not considering the prior offenses? I mean, that is what enhanced penalty structure is. That's what it means to take into account the prior offenses, is that you are taking into account the prior offenses. Otherwise, what are you doing?
Yes, that's true. You obviously are going to have to take them into account, because if they do not exist, this would not be a seventh offense. But that does not mean that any of the punishment is for those cases. That's how it works.
It doesn't go backwards to those cases, but the new punishment is, by very definition, based on all of the fact that there were these prior convictions in those other cases. That's what the case law says.
Except that it's not a punishment for any of those cases. And if this court rules that way, it's going to have to explain why all of those cases, including a lot of Supreme Court cases, are wrong.
And is there a Supreme Court court case that actually talks about refusal? Because wouldn't that be the distinction that could be made, that refusal is specifically tied to a Fourth Amendment right to not have a needle stuck in your arm, as Justice Bradley put it, and that is the distinguishing factor here?
I guess the court could do that. I don't think it really makes sense, because again, what you did in the first case is not going to be punished when it's enhanced.
Well, Mr. Sanders, is your argument this, that had the judge in this case said, I'm sentencing you on an OWI 7, and because you refused back in
96,
because you refused back in 96, I'm adding on an additional 5 years, I take it your argument here today would be different, correct?
An additional 5 years to... That is above the max the seventh, or that is within the max, but it's more time than he would have given without.
Maximum for an OWI 7. Okay, the judge put in. But he said, you know, I'm looking at all the factors, and I'm imposing the sentence I'm imposing, and part of that, may I continue to ask my question?
Yes, and then you may answer,
thank
and
you.
Then you're done.
But part of this sentence, 2 years of it, 3 years of it, a discrete amount of time, is because you refused back in 96. Is your argument today that had the judge said that is Dalton, but because the judge did not segregate out any particular length of the sentence for the 1996 refusal, that everything that happened in the sentencing court in this case was legal and okay?
Everything that occurred in this case in the 2016 or 17 sentencing was absolutely legal. There was nothing wrong with it whatsoever. The court imposed a sentence for his crime, only for his crime. It had to, of course, know that he had done a lot of things in the past, which made it a seventh, and therefore it had the minimum and maximum penalty. Had the judge said, the maximum penalty here is, say, 12 years, and I would only give you 9, except in 96 you refused a blood draw, and I want to give you more time for that in addition to the fact that you have 6 of these, then that, I guess, would be Dalton. It's a little different because it is a future thing, and in Dalton, that was something where he drove drunk, he was tried. I didn't mean that. He drove drunk, he was sentenced, and he got extra time for what he did in that case. Here, it's something that happened 22 years later. It doesn't really go back to the search. It has nothing to do with the search. It has nothing to do with his actual sentence in his case in 1996. It's something completely separate. And it's different because of the sentencing laws.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is David Malkus, and I represent Scott Ferrett. In Birchfield v. North Dakota, the U.S. Supreme Court held that criminal penalties may not be imposed for a refusal to consent to a warrantless blood draw. And in State v. Dalton, this court recognized that a lengthier sentence is certainly a criminal penalty. And Mr. Ferretz?
Well, is there a statute that requires this to be counted as a prior?
Yes, the statute.
So do we have to find that unconstitutional in order to rule for you?
Yes, the court would have to find that.
And what's the burden of proof to find that statute unconstitutional?
The burden of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt that the statute is unconstitutional. And so what the Court of Appeals found and what my position is that Wisconsin's OWI statutory penalty scheme is unconstitutional.
So if you win today, really, everyone should refuse to be tested when they're pulled over for an OWI, because then they can face no further penalty for that other than a potential civil penalty, right?
I don't agree with that. First, there is still the civil penalty, the license revocation also.
Right, but not, I mean, if that's it, there's no downside to saying you don't get my blood, breath, or urine, and you cannot have a test result that might show me above the legal limit, right? I mean, there would be no incentive other than potentially a ticket, no incentive to allow law enforcement to ever test you for an alcohol level, right?
I think that the same argument could have been made in Dalton, and I think it was made in the dissent that this
Well, Dalton's a little different because the judge specifically increased that case's penalty. This case, we're talking about whether it counts as a prior. There are a lot of things in the law that count as priors, or because of your status as a particular offender, you face different penalties for doing the same thing again or a different thing. You face increased penalties in a subsequent crime because of a prior behavior conviction. And so I'm trying to figure out what are the ramifications of what you argue. In part, I think they are, no one in their right mind should ever agree to be tested if they're pulled over for an OWI.
Right.
I think that you could make the same argument regardless of this case, that there's no, in Dalton, the dissent made the argument that this would encourage refusals. I don't know of any evidence that there's a significant increase in refusals since the Dalton case.
Wouldn't it open up arguments for a whole host of cases where because of a past conviction or past behavior, you face an increased criminal penalty charge, a charge that carries with it an increased criminal penalty? Where's the stopping point for that?
I think the stopping point is the Fourth Amendment, and that in this case, Mr. Ferret exercised his Fourth Amendment right to refuse a warrantless blood draw, and that he received increased penalties as a result of that. And I know that the state argues that a refusal is just like a crime, that it cites to all of this case law that talks about repeater statutes and how prior convictions can be used to elevate penalties in subsequent cases. I don't see a refusal as being analogous to a crime or another any other legitimate sentencing factor.
Isn't a sentencing factor. It changes where this person sits. I mean, in OWI law, the first one is civil. The second one, because of that first civil offense for which you cannot spend time in jail as a penalty, it becomes a second. So why wouldn't that be unreasonable to have the first one be a civil and the second one be criminal? I don't understand that logic. Is it because the first one you don't have a constitutional right to drive drunk, but the second you have a constitutional right to refuse?
Yes, you have a constitutional right to refuse to hold the government to its burden.
So under your logic, the refusal law is unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yes, Wisconsin's penalty scheme, which includes the revocation statute, the refusal statute. Yes.
The remedy then is that you go back to have a trial and all the charges are reinstituted, right? You don't go back for sentencing on a crime that you say isn't a seventh or a sixth or a fifth or whatever. you unwind it because you are in the position now of saying that wasn't a knowing, free, and voluntary plea to agree and to agree that my refusal was unreasonable. So now your client should face all those penalties and charges and have the right to a trial, right? It's not just a resentencing. I don't understand that logic at all.
In this case, it is just a resentencing. Mr. Ferrett specifically filed a post-conviction motion requesting a resentencing, and this is discussed to some extent in the briefing in the Court of Appeals level that the Travis is referenced, that when a judge is operating under the assumption that higher penalties apply, then...
But higher penalties apply because it's that number. And it's that number because a refusal was counted to get it to that number. If that number doesn't make that number offense for which those penalties apply, the plea to that number offense was not knowing, free, and voluntary, right?
The number of prior offenses is not an element of the offense. So I don't see the number as being determinative of whether a defendant would be entitled to plea withdrawal in this type of a situation. It would instead, I suppose, you know, if a defendant in this type of a situation asked for plea withdrawal based on the fact that they were told that the penalties were higher than they should have been, then they could...
Well, what if this flipped it from a misdemeanor to a felony? Your argument would be the same? You go back for felony sentencing?
No, you would go back for a misdemeanor sentencing. You couldn't be you couldn't receive a prison sentence if it was an OWI third.
Counsel, which provision of the Constitution would you point to as requiring us to declare part of our law unconstitutional?
Which part of the Constitution?
Yeah.
The Fourth Amendment, that
okay.
You have a right to be free from unreasonable seizures.
Okay, searches. So Birchfield was a Fourth Amendment case, right? Under Birchfield, is Wisconsin's scheme a violation of the Fourth Amendment?
Yes.
Let me clarify. Under Birchfield, is Wisconsin's refusal and revocation proceedings, apart from this penalty enhancer, is that unconstitutional?
No, it's the counting of refusals that results in the penalties, which is unconstitutional.
So,
scheme, not...
Yeah.
There isn't a way to isolate one particular statute or subsection and say that the unconstitutional part
right.
is the scheme as a whole that penalizes.
So, Mr. Ferrett, is that how you pronounce it?
Ferrett.
So, Mr. Ferrett, when he refused and then was revoked... was he unreasonably searched in any way when that occurred at the time?
Well, there was a blood draw in this case without a warrant, and blood draws are presumptively unreasonable under the...
Well, you're not challenging his prior revocation. Well, I thought you just told me that Wisconsin's scheme for revocation, refusal and revocation is totally fine under Birchfield, which seems to me it is, right? So Mr. Ferrett, when he refused and then was revoked, at that point, that's what I'm talking about right now, were his Fourth Amendment rights violated?
In that moment, there wasn't a violation of any violation of Birchfield.
Okay.
It was the imposition of criminal penalties in 2017. And a criminal penalty
sure.
is a criminal penalty, whether it's imposed in 2017 or 1997.
I want to take this logic further here, right? So Birchfield says that you cannot threaten a criminal penalty for refusal, okay? And says that's a violation of your right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, okay? At that time, you're telling me what happened. Put aside this particular case, everything that happened there, start to finish, totally consistent with the Fourth Amendment. It's over and finished. He has been searched, and it was totally consistent with the Constitution. There's no basis under Birchfield or anything else to challenge that any violation of his Fourth Amendment rights had occurred. Now, the argument here is that... his right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures that occurred years prior was now violated, even though it wasn't at the time, because the state is now using that civil penalty, which is totally constitutional, under Birchfield, to do something different. So exactly when was he unreasonably searched? Because that's the text of the Fourth Amendment. Birchfield says you're unreasonably searched if you're threatened with a criminal penalty for the refusal. So are you saying that the search that occurred back in was it 2016 when this originally occurred?
1996.
Sorry. That the search that occurred in 1996, which is totally constitutional, now became unconstitutional under the Fourth Amendment, that he was unreasonably searched? Because your argument to us is that the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, based upon an action that took place in 1996, now requires something different 28 years later in this court.
I guess I don't know that I'm willing to concede that the search in 1996 was entirely reasonable or constitutionally permissible, because the U.S. Supreme Court in Missouri v. McNeely held that there is no per se justification to take a warrantless blood draw, and he did have his blood drawn without a warrant in 1996.
Sure, but nobody's challenging that, right? I mean, what you're talking about is a much broader argument. Let's assume we're post McNeely. We're talking about any search that occurs, okay? And the Wisconsin scheme that happens all the time, people refuse and they can be civilly revoked. That's totally constitutional. Under Birchfield, Birchfield is abundantly clear about that. That search happens, it's completed. The text of the Fourth Amendment has been complied with under United States Supreme Court precedent. All we're doing is applying United States Supreme Court precedent. So your argument logically means that the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, even though it wasn't violated at the time, somehow was violated decades later by something that occurred in an entirely different criminal scheme, that the Fourth Amendment somehow requires to strike down a totally different statute.
I think a good example would be that you have the right to refuse a warrantless search of your home, and you can't be criminally penalized for that. Let's say the police do search the home and find evidence, and it results in a criminal conviction. And then 20 years later, a judge references that prior refusal to search the home and says, I'm giving you a higher penalty, or if there was a statute that allowed for a higher penalty 20 years after the fact for refusal to search a warrantless home.
It stayed unconstitutional from its inception.
Imagine a totally constitutional search. Over, done with, fine, finished. Okay, totally constitutional, complied with every provision of the Constitution. Now you're arguing that search that occurred years earlier now violated the Fourth Amendment.
Birchfield holds that the imposition of criminal penalties on refusal to consent to a warrantless blood draw makes the search unreasonable, and that is what happened in this case. The criminal penalties were imposed in 2017.
Or alternatively, we're a world away from Birchfield, because Birchfield only says that you can't threaten criminal penalties as the price of your Fourth Amendment at that search at that time. Anyway, thank you.
Counsel, I want to jump in here because Justice Hagedorn framed your argument differently than how I read it, so I want to make sure I'm understanding your argument. I'm not understanding your argument necessarily to be that at the time the judge on the 7th imposed a sentence beyond 10 years, that at that time your client's constitutional rights were violated. What I understand your argument to be, and please tell me if I am misunderstanding it, is that at the time the blood draw was requested and your client refused the blood draw, that his constitutional rights were violated because the statute does impose a potential criminal penalty for that refusal under the statutory scheme. So is your argument the way Justice Hagedorn framed it or the way I just framed it?
I do agree with the way that you framed it, and that at the time that he refused in 1996 as the statute.
Because I think it's really important to be clear about when the constitutional violation occurred. And it sounded like you were conceding to the framing posed by Justice Hagedorn. You've backtracked from that now. Is that accurate?
I think it's a fair point to make that the violation occurred in 1996 because the statutes allowed for subsequent enhanced criminal penalties.
For your client, what's the criminal penalty if the revocation counts as a prior, and what's the criminal penalty if the revocation does not count as a prior?
I believe that he was convicted of a seventh offense and that that is a Class F felony, so 12 and a half years, and that if the refusal had not counted, it would have been a sixth offense, which is a Class G felony, so 10 years.
Okay. So it is the fact of the refusal that makes it a seventh offense for which there are increased penalties, right?
Yes.
So when your client pled guilty, having taken probably thousands of pleas in matters, the judge has to advise your client of the maximum potential penalties. So what penalties was your client advised of?
He was advised of the penalties that would apply if this was a seventh offense.
Okay. So what part of your client pleading guilty to those penalties, knowing those penalties could be imposed, what part of that can be knowing, free, and voluntary if, in fact, those are not at all the maximum penalties? And his plea, which included a plea to each of the priors, including the revocation, was a plea accepting responsibility for those all being counted as prior offenses, such that he would be placed at that maximum penalty. How can that be knowing, free, and voluntary when he pled guilty to the wrong number, acknowledged the wrong number, acknowledged the wrong maximum, and agreed that he was convicted and this would be his seventh OWI?
I think the case law that's on point is State v. Taylor and State v. Cross, and this court held that overstating the maximum penalty.
No, it's the crime. I mean, this is a different crime. Seventh offense is a different crime than pleading to a sixth. I mean, I was careful to make sure when I had someone enter a plea, we were meticulous. In fact, people fight about whether the priors count or not, whether you can really use this or not, whether or not a Nebraska prior is really legitimate or has the same elements. That can be a bone of contention that's significant because it often can put people from civil to criminal, criminal misdemeanor to criminal felony. There's a lot at stake as to what number it is. So I don't see how you really want us to have the case law be, yeah, doesn't really matter if the judge goes through the priors. The judge can just sort of guess, wing it, and, you know, if it's just a couple years off here or there, no big deal.
In State v. Cross, this court held that a slight overstatement of the maximum penalties doesn't
entitle.
There was
no prior that changed that in State versus Cross. The defendant agreed to the facts. The facts of Cross are very different than the facts here. You are specifically, the sole reason you're here is because you're saying one of these doesn't count and it changes this so much that I deserve a new sentence. You're not here saying one of these doesn't count and it's close enough because, you know, the penalties are within a couple of years, so just it's okay if my client gets a couple more years. You're not saying that. You're saying it is so significant that this prior doesn't count that the maximum my client can get is less. That's what you're saying. The whole thing changes. How can your client have pled knowingly, freely, and voluntarily to this 12 and a half year maximum with acknowledgement of each of these counting as prior convictions? How can you say your client knowingly, freely, and voluntarily knew that was the case for him and still make the argument you're making?
Well, Your Honor, you keep mentioning that the number of priors is essential to the case, but it's essential because it reflects on the penalties that the defendant faces. And so I would refer again to Cross and the court's holding in that case that slight overstatements of the maximum penalties do not entitle a defendant to plea withdrawal. And the court said that it depends on all of the facts and circumstances.
So let's say we've got a three strikes, you're out case. Changes things, right? Makes it a maximum life, right? If someone said, I didn't really have that prior conviction, it wouldn't be a three strikes, you're out kind of case, right? But you're saying they should just go back for resentencing them?
I think in that type of a case, if the defendant wanted to file a motion for plea withdrawal, they would certainly be entitled to file the motion. And I think especially in a three strikes type of a situation, if you're...
It's solely the priors maximum, that changes it to life, right?
Right. And I think that they, in that type of a situation, they may be entitled to plea withdrawal. I don't think that the case law is entitled.
Counsel, are there other jurisdictions that also are fined similarly to what you're asking us to conclude?
I cited to several other jurisdictions in my brief in a footnote, and to varying degrees, those other jurisdictions have come to a similar conclusion that this court did in State v. Dalton, and have found that Birchfield doesn't just speak to the impermissibility of making a refusal a standalone crime, but that it also speaks to the wider impermissibility of criminal penalties, and that a longer sentence is a criminal penalty that's improper.
Any of those jurisdictions have a first offense be civil, like Wisconsin?
I don't know, and Birchfield is a relatively recent decision.
No, I'm talking about the jurisdictions you're telling us, oh gosh, this is how everybody does it. So any of those have civil first offenses? I don't think there's another state maybe in the country that does that, but I'm wondering if the ones you're telling us to follow do.
I don't believe that if we're talking specifically about making OWI the first offense non-criminal, no, I don't believe that the states...
Aren't we talking about refusal, regardless of whether they find it...
Civil conviction.
Aren't these states ones where the courts found, and one of them, some of them are cited in the Court of Appeals case as well, where the court found that Birchfield means that you can't count refusals to submit to warrantless blood draws as increasing penalties the way that Wisconsin does?
I believe that the cases speak to the fact that you can't elevate criminal penalties in an OWI case based on the fact that the defendant refused.
Counsel, I note that the facts in this case are that there is only the countable conviction of the refusal and then the revocation. It is not accompanied by what we very often see, and that is the companion OWI case emanating out of the same circumstances. And as a result of that, and of course our statutory scheme is, if you have an OWI and you have the refusal, you only can count that as one under the statutory scheme. Here they only had one, the refusal, but I don't think that that's the norm. So my sense was that the facts of this case may limit the reach of what you're asking for. Could you comment on that? Am I correct or incorrect?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And statutorily, when a refusal and an OWI occur as part of the same incident, that counts as only one prior offense for the purposes of determining penalties in a separate and subsequent OWI case. So the court's decision in this case would have no application to situations where there is a refusal and an accompanying OWI conviction.
Is that the same with BAC? Because listening to what you said, if McNeely had applied, they would have had to get a warrant to take the blood from your client back in 1996, and he could have been charged with a BAC offense at that point. And so would it have the same effect? The refusal wouldn't matter if you have a BAC, right?
Right. Yes.
Counsel, I'd like to return to the topic of remedy if the court agrees with your position on the principal issue in this case. It was originally raised by the Chief Justice. So your client entered into a plea deal with the state, and that deal was that your client would plead to the seventh offense, and in exchange, I think the state dropped most, if not all, of the other charges. Is that correct?
Yes.
So the Court of Appeals agreed with your position and commuted the conviction to a sixth offense OWI. Under our cases, we look at plea agreements like we look at contracts. So it doesn't seem like the state is getting the benefit of the bargain it made with your client. So it strikes me that commuting the conviction to a six isn't quite the right remedy. Shouldn't the plea deal be vacated or voided, because if we agree with your position, it was not constitutionally entered into?
I think that that would be a motion that the state would have to bring, that they would have to argue that their contract contractual obligations weren't fulfilled and that they're asking for plea withdrawal. I don't know that the court on its own would be sending this back to the trial court for a new trial or for new plea negotiations. Mr. Ferret brought a post-conviction motion in this case. He specifically for a resentencing hearing on the basis of the fact that this was an increased, that this should not have counted as a seventh offense. And so we're asking for resentencing in this case.
But doesn't that make the entire agreement invalid? So I'm not sure that whether the state asked for it or not, I'm not sure Mr. Sanders did. Perhaps he can address that in rebuttal. But regardless, I think if we accept your position, the agreement is invalid. And so how could we sort of uphold it in part, again, because the state entered into it on the condition that your client plead to something that we're now potentially going to say could not be constitutionally pled to?
I just know as a post-conviction attorney that when I have a client who wants plea withdrawal on a, you know, say a specific count that they've pled to and other charges were dismissed and read in, if you go ahead with the request for plea withdrawal on that count, yes, there's a possibility that the state could argue that there was a breach of the plea agreement and that this should undo the dismissed and read in charges and reopen the whole case. But the state hasn't requested that in this case.
Isn't the distinction in an OWI case and other cases involving an enhanced penalty that is not an element of the crime? If you have a case where the element of the crime is affected, of course, but in a situation where the element of the crime is not the enhancer, I mean, is that the distinction? I remember having cases taking pleas where we thought it was one thing and it turns out to be another, and my understanding of the case law as you described it was that if it's a greater penalty, of course they get to withdraw their plea, but if it's a lesser penalty because one of the convictions didn't count, they couldn't find the documentation from another state, that's the distinction.
Yes, that's correct, and the elements of OWI are only operating at first and second while under the influence. And I believe that there's case law as well that speaks to that it's a better practice to determine the number of prior OWI offenses at the plea hearing, but that can also be determined at the sentencing hearing. So it's
how can that be if someone needs to know the maximum penalties? How can that possibly be? Oh, we'll just take a plea for two elements and we'll figure out that it's your 10th offense later. That can't possibly be. They wouldn't know what they're pleading to. They wouldn't know their exposure. How can you possibly say that?
I think that it goes back to, again, this court's decision in State v. Cross, and that it depends on the facts and circumstances. This isn't something that was, you know, litigated. Mr. Ferret has never asked for plea withdrawal. His post-conviction
right.
motion
it,
is...
Whether he asked for it or not, our court has jurisprudence on remedy situations. And I don't see how you can argue your client knowingly, freely, and voluntarily pled to a sixth offense when he didn't.
I don't know how that's different than State v. Cross, when the defendant's being told that the maximum penalty is something like 5 years in excess of what it actually is. And again, this is not an element of the offense. The number of priors is not an element of the offense. That
Counsel, in Cross, did the court commute the sentence?
No, Cross denied the motion for plea withdrawal.
I'll ask
Go ahead. You were asking a question.
Okay. We have a lot, or we have substantial amount of jurisprudence on collateral consequences of conviction. Is there any case that you can point to that would suggest an enhanced penalty is anything other than a collateral consequence of a future enhanced penalty is anything other than a collateral consequence of conviction?
No, Your Honor, no.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Sanders. What are the consequences if this is a mere collateral consequence?
I didn't hear what you said. I'm sorry.
What would happen if this is merely a collateral consequence, the number? I mean, I almost wonder if the defense wants to be careful what it wishes for on this.
I'd have to think about that some more, but I think that in a real sense, what occurred here would only be a collateral consequence, because it's not the same thing as in Dalton, where he drove drunk, he was sentenced, and the court said, for the refusal in this case, you're getting this time. Here, the only possible threat was that he was told at the time, you won't go to jail if you say no to a blood test. But someday in the future, if you drive drunk and you don't have a conviction in this case for in your old case, then someday we might use your refusal revocation, and that might make it worse in the future, in 22 years, if you drive drunk again. At most, that is a extreme collateral consequence, because for anyone who chooses not to drive drunk again, it's not any threat. There is simply no threat. There's nothing there. And on that, I think to get back to what Justice Hagedorn was referring to, in the Supreme Court, all they really talked about in Birchfield was the search, and then there was the penalty if you say no. And those are two completely separate things. And the search was over at the time his blood was drawn in this case, and it wasn't drawn because of the implied consent law. He's not challenging his search, and that was over in 1996. All he's challenging is that now, because he refused, he can't get more time now for his 2016 case, which again is contrary to all of the sentencing law. And had he chosen not to drive drunk again, he never would have had any kind of a penalty. It simply isn't a criminal penalty. It's an entirely different thing. On the constitutional right to refuse, I think this court should be very clear that there isn't an across-the-board right to refuse a blood draw. There's only a right to refuse if it is an unreasonable search. If you have a search warrant, it's a reasonable search. If you have exigent circumstances, it's a reasonable search. If you have consent, it's a reasonable search.
Right, and wouldn't all
if you have implied
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Please finish.
Okay, if you have implied consent and you don't threaten jail for refusing, it's a reasonable search. And this court said that on the same day that it released State v. Dalton, it also released State v. Mitchell. And in a concurring opinion from Justice Kelly, he said, we understand the right that the people of Wisconsin have a constitutionally protected right to be free from warrantless, unreasonable searches. And the people of Wisconsin may operationalize that constitutionally protected right by refusing warrantless, unreasonable searches. That's all it's about. And in that same opinion, in a dissent from Justice Bradley, it says one has a constitutional right to refuse a search absent a warrant or an applicable exception, which is obviously true. And under an implied consent law, as long as you don't threaten jail, that is an applicable exception. Here, there is no threat of jail. He wasn't jailed. He's never been jailed for his refusal. He didn't serve a single day in jail for that refusal in 1996. And he's not now. He's serving time in jail now,
but the statute,
because it's a seventh offense.
But the statute does threaten criminal penalties for the refusal. And I think my understanding is that is what the defendant here is challenging.
At the absolute most, it says if you drive drunk again someday in the future, it might be treated more harshly. And then it's conceivable that there could be a penalty there. But again, that penalty is for the new crime. It's not for the old one. It's not for the refusal.
But the extra years that he can be imprisoned are for the refusal.
It's not a but-for test. As the Supreme Court has said over and over again, it's not a but-for test. If that were the case, then but-for his... If I may say one more thing?
Yes.
If this had not been a blood test that he refused in 96, but had been a breath test, where he obviously and clearly has no constitutional right to refuse a breath test, it would work exactly the same way. Right now, when this became a seventh and one of his priors was his refusal to take a breath test, for which there's absolutely no right to refuse, he still would have the exact same sentence now, and it can't be that any of that time is attributed to his refusal to take a breath test in 1996, because again, you can't get any time for that. He plainly wasn't threatened with jail for that, and even if he had been, it would have been constitutional. It just doesn't work that way. That's just not how sentencing law works. He wasn't threatened with any jail. Thank
okay.
you.
Maybe how they were. All right. Thank you very much for your good arguments and briefs. We are going to take a brief recess, and we will reconvene for the second case this morning.